And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. If you wish to join our program, our conversation today, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Oh boy, did I get some feedback yesterday after the program when I said yesterday on this program that Sanders and Trump were similar in some aspects. And I've got people that were supporting Trump asking me, how can I compare their candidate with a socialist? And I've got the Sanders people appalled that I associate their candidate with Trump. I want to return to that subject today, and actually in just a moment, so I can calm both sides down in terms of what I was talking about. But first, I want to get into something I wanted to share yesterday, but just simply ran out of time. And that is, our listeners are way, way ahead of the political experts. And all of you should have political PhDs, political science PhDs, in my mind, given what I read yesterday in the Times Argus by a UVM professor. I'll explain in a moment. But he would have saved himself a lot of time if he just listened in to all of you instead of spending his time reading, because you were way ahead of him in terms of what he had to say. And then we'll talk with John Kalacki. He's the executive director of the Flynn Center for Performing Arts. Ken Squires will join us because he wants to share some thoughts on the presidential primaries. That is going to be interesting. Who knows what Ken is going to say? And then Catriona McCarty, and she's being inducted into the Vermont State College Hall of Fame. Find out why she's being inducted and the ceremonies and what it means to her to be inducted into the Vermont State College Hall of Fame. So let's start out. And I promise I'll get to the Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump comparisons in a minute. But let's start out with how smart this audience is and way, way ahead of what are the so-called political experts out there. Yesterday in the Times Argus, a UVM professor said this about the VPR poll. And you remember VPR released a poll almost a couple of weeks ago, that talked about various things. It talked about the primary, and it had Donald Trump winning. It had Bernie Sanders winning big. Actually, they were pretty close in the Sanders one. You know, the poll was conducted in February, and there was a lot of campaigning between the time that the poll was done and the actual results. And on the Republican side, it was a little bit closer than the poll projected. But they projected that Donald Trump would win, and he actually did. And yesterday in the Times Argus, a UVM college professor said this about the poll. It said the low approval ratings for Governor Shumlin, and remember, the poll had Governor Shumlin upside down, meaning more people disapproved of Governor Shumlin than approved of the way that he's doing his job. So the professor writes this: the low approval ratings for Governor Shumlin and the low levels of support that most gubernatorial candidates register in the poll raise a number of questions about the coming gubernatorial contest. Do the low approval ratings for the current Democratic governor mean that Vermonters want to see a governor from a different party? Or do the numbers mean that Vermonters want a governor who is a Montpelier outsider? Do the low levels of support for the two contenders for the Democratic nomination mean that another candidate should jump in the mix? Does Phil Scott lead in the early trial heats mean that he is likely to become the next governor? The answer is no, 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 and no. To answer them any other way is to read too much results in the polls. So, you know, he says the answer is no, no, no. And we perhaps all agree on that. And then the final no is interesting. And let's discuss that. If you remember, a couple of weeks ago, we started this discussion, and we started out by saying there is no doubt, and boy, are you, is this audience way ahead of the political pundits here. The conclusions were this. There is no doubt at this stage in the race, the news for Scott is encouraging. Of the people that have already decided, he polls 66% would vote for him. However, many of you know that if you looked at the poll, and many of you did, if you take a closer look at the poll, 71% of Vermonters surveyed haven't decided or aren't sure who they're going to support for governor. So all those voters, 71% of the voters, are up for grabs. So, yeah, the race hasn't been decided. We could have told the professor that long ago, 2 weeks ago. Actually, we could have probably done it without the poll. The second thing is that the professor brings up that Scott is likely ahead because of name recognition. Well, duh. I mean, right now, the lieutenant governor has a higher profile than any other candidates. We discussed that. We told, you know, again, the professor should have tuned in to what you were saying. We discussed that. We said that, but, and I think where the professor is going on this, but we said that that will change overnight when the opponents start advertising, when they increase their earned media presence, when they start distributing campaign material. We also talked about something that the professor doesn't talk about, and that is who is at the top of the Republican ticket. That's going to make a difference, whether it's Phil Scott or Bruce Lisman. That's an even trickier sort of maneuver and challenge for a Republican. If it's Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, that has a problem. Now, that can be overcome. Governor Douglas has done it when he had an unpopular president on the ticket in 08, and he did it when he had a very popular Democrat running in, when he had an unpopular Republican in 04 at the top of the ticket, and a popular Democrat, Barack Obama, in 08. So it can be overcome. Where I think we all differed from the professor is that Democrats are going to have to contend with a couple of things. One is the lack of enthusiasm for the current governor. Now, the professor says that that doesn't make any difference, but that flies in the face of common sense. If you associate with someone, let's just take it in everyday life. Everyday life. Let's take politics right out of it. If you associate with someone that is disliked because of his or her actions, don't you think that it will have an impact on who wishes to buddy up with you? Of course it will. And here's an experiment that I would say, if you don't believe us, this audience, then here's an experiment for the Democratic candidates. Go ahead and tie yourself to Governor Shumlin and see what happens. And for the Republicans, if it's Cruz or Trump, go ahead and tie yourself to Cruz and Trump and see what happens. It's not going to work. So it was interesting that I found yesterday, and I wanted to get to this yesterday and didn't have enough time, that this audience all deserves PhDs from my for political science from my perspective. So good job out there being way ahead of what are the political experts and what they are saying. So let's head back to a category or a topic that many of you chimed in after I got off the show yesterday on, is that the comparison that I made with Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. And a few of you were in wonderment how I was making a comparison between the two. They seem to be politically the odd couple of politics. And one of, you know, the Trump people were saying, well, wait a second. You know, Trump is an aggressive capitalist. He's not a socialist. And how can you do that? And the Sanders people were saying, you know, how they were appalled that I can associate their candidate with Trump. I mean, they called him all sorts of names, which are, you know, which a lot of people have called him. Don't get me wrong here. They are very, very much different. And in the area, policy areas, they are diametrically opposed to one another. But if you take the policy issues and the solutions aside, and again, they are profound, the difference. Sanders and Trump have found success in Vermont and elsewhere across the country by establishing a connection with a growing number of voters that really feel disenfranchised in the political process, and telling them that through them, through Sanders or Trump, they finally have a voice. They have found a voice. You know, where they're most common is what they're running on. And that is that they've touched a nerve with voters that really is resonating. And that message is that the political system is controlled by elites. And their sole, the elites, their sole purpose is to perpetuate their own power over politics and the economy. That's where Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are similar. Now, they would be appalled, probably both would be appalled, if they thought I was connecting the two. And both probably would deny that either of them have anything in common. I get that. They don't want to be associated with each other. But they are connected. They are connected with the message. They understood very early, both understood very early, that voter anger out there is profound, and it's underestimated by the elites, by the political elites. And even though Bernie Sanders is a democratic socialist, a self-proclaimed democratic socialist, and Trump is I would consider him an aggressive capitalist, they are not playing by the rules created by what they call the elites. And in fact, both have shunned money away. They have not accepted money from political action committees. They aren't playing by the same rules. They aren't playing by the same playbook that normally is established for the candidates, and they're being successful. I mean, they aren't taking money from political action committees. Everybody else is, including Hillary Clinton. And, you know, they're doing it different ways. Trump is using his own personal wealth to fund his campaign, and Sanders is relying on those small donations that come in from many of the supporters that he has convinced about his message. You know what they've both done? They've both recognized, well before anybody else, and, you know, you hear Hillary Clinton starting to come to the party, you hear others starting to come to the party, but they have recognized well before others that the economic, social, and political frustration of Americans. You know, they're both brash, they're both boisterous, both have brought new voters to their respective parties. And that's not establishment voters. Those are new voters that they have captured with their message. And both are committed to continuing their fight. You know what's interesting? And it started on last Tuesday night when both are calling what they're doing a movement. Now, like I said, there's a whole host of difference in policy issues. I mean, you couldn't find two people as opposite as these people. But, you know, my question, they have very similar ways that they are connecting to voters. And that's what I mean, that they are similar to one another. And I got a good, robust response the other day when I said that. Wanted to explain it a little more. If you want to join our conversation about what's going on in presidential politics, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I also mentioned the other day when I was talking about how they have similar messages, how they have touched the voters in perhaps the same way, that they will be different, and their efforts are starting to diverge now in terms of what is happening and the impact on their parties. You know, a Trump victory may have more of an impact on the Republican Party than a Sanders defeat in the Democratic Party. A Trump victory has the potential of fracturing the Republicans. Look, established conservatives don't believe that Trump is a conservative. They don't believe he is a conservative in the likes of Ronald Reagan. In fact, he does shun the orthodoxy of the conservative movement and what Ronald Reagan had said, a small federal government that stays out of the affairs. I mean, what Ronald Reagan wanted was a small federal bureaucracy that stays out of the affairs of Americans' daily lives. Trump is a populist. He's not necessarily a conservative. And as a populist, this is an interesting sort of thing for the Republicans to remember. As a populist, he's not beholden to a particular party or those that are running under the Republican banner, but only to himself. He seems to have, at least in my opinion, he seems to have little concern with what happens to other Republicans because of his stances. And he doesn't instill loyalty because he's not loyal to those in the party. Of course, moderates are appalled by his statements. So this coalition that has existed in the party, the conservative movement, the moderate movement, they both have concerns over Donald Trump. On the other hand, if you look at the Democratic Party, a Sanders loss would not necessarily fracture the Democratic Party. It may weaken it, but it may not fracture it the way that Donald Trump will in the Republican Party. Because here's the way and the reason the Democrats would be weakened with a Sanders loss. The Sanders people don't see Hillary Clinton fighting for the same things that Sanders is. Fundamental change in our political process is what Sanders believes. And yet Clinton is an establishment candidate. So they don't believe when Hillary Clinton espouses these sort of principles. They don't believe she's going to carry through on it because they believe she will want to maintain the status quo. So you may have massive dissatisfaction in the Democratic Party. You may have Sanders supporters not coming out for the election, but I doubt you will see the fracture of the Democratic Party the insurrection within the Democratic Party that you may see in the Republican Party. And this is where it gets really concerning. Let's take Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders out of it, because they are only individual candidates. But if the political parties fail to listen to Americans clamoring for change, and that's what they're doing, they're clamoring for change. They want change. If they continue to ignore the concerns of Americans, in my opinion, there's a likelihood that the very existence of the two-party structure could eventually be in danger. And that senses into a whole different discussion where turmoil and other things are what we can expect. What do you think? Give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Steve and Barry. Steve, you're
on. Yes, I totally agree with you. I think people are just so fed up with the politics on both sides of the party, people not being able to come together to make decisions in Washington. It's not just the Democrats. It's not just the Republicans. It's the independents and everybody. And what Bernie and Donald offer is an alternative to that. And it's very clear. There are the old guard politicians out there, the ones that are watching the results from Vermont, where Bernie Sanders got 86.1% of the vote, Hillary got 13%, that are still going to go out and support Hillary. They're not representing the interests of Vermonters. They're not listening to us, and they haven't been listening to us. And I think that is a problem.
Steve, let me ask you this. The superdelegates that have already committed to Clinton say they're going to still stay with Clinton. That's pretty much the hierarchy of the Democratic Party. Do you think they should, or do you think they should move over? They have a choice. They can move.
I think they should represent their constituents. They're representing their friendships and personal relationships in Washington. And it's only their friends and their allies that they're doing this. I mean, it's rigged. The Democratic Party has rigged this election to where the superdelegates will ultimately make the decision to vote for this. And that's just as rigged as Wall Street, you know, buying votes from the Republicans. To me, I really see no difference. The Democratic old guard is out of step. We're starting to see a political revolution here.
Steve, thank you very much for your phone call. Are we seeing a political revolution? Are we seeing things that are changing here in America? Are we headed into times where this two-party structure is starting to fracture? And is it now the time? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I know that some of you at least are upset with, you know, me trying to draw the conclusion between Trump and Bernie, but I think it's a valid conclusion. In this way, they are hitting the voters, they are attracting the voters in the same way with the same message that the political system is controlled by elites whose sole purpose, in my mind at least, is perpetuating their own power over our politics and our economy. Do you agree? Do you agree that Bernie and Trump are hitting that message? Do you agree that voter anger is profound, as I purport, and often estimated by the underestimated by the party elites? What do you think? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're going to switch up a little bit. We're going to get away from politics until we get Ken Squire back in here and that wants to talk about politics in the second hour. But what I want to do is welcome to our WDEV studios, John Kalacki, who's the executive director of the Flynn Center for Performing Arts. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mike. And, you know, I was sitting outside your studio for the last half hour, and you were like a jazz musician, the way you were flowing back and forth. It was awesome to hear. And I thought, God, if he was playing, you know, big bass or something, you'd be flying. So that was beautiful to listen to.
Well, you're so kind. So let me ask you, what's new at the Flint?
Well, tonight, Bella Fleck and his wife, Abigail Washburn, they just won a Grammy for Best Folk Album this year. They're tonight. Tomorrow night, Joan Baez is at the Flint. She sold out. Sunday, Downton Abbey is ending, and Vermont PBS is having their fundraiser at the Flynn, and you get to see it at the Flynn, and you can dance on stage afterwards. And
do you have to dress up like that?
You can if you want. So you could be, you and your wife could be very aristocratic if you'd like, and don't bring a horse in though. All right,
okay. We'll talk about horses in a little while.
A little bit. I hope we do. I always like to. Then next week we have a family program, Cat in the Hat, which is of course the Dr. Seuss book, but what we've been doing with the family programs is we've been We call them sensory friendly, and it's also a way to adapt them slightly for families that have kids on the autism spectrum to feel like they're welcome at the Flynn. So their lights are a little higher, the sound is a little lower. It's okay if the kids are standing up, walking around. It's okay if they make some noise and talk. There's a quiet room if people need to go back out. There's no noise-canceling headphones for the kids. There's fidgets for them. And what we found was everybody had a good time with that. Those that had toddlers think, God, I can bring my kid to the Flynn and not be worried about it. So that's been a big benefit for us.
How do you decide which – you got a great lineup here. How do you decide which performers to bring to the Flynn?
Oh, it's solely what I like, Mike. Actually not. Steve McQueen is our artistic director, and he does a great job. But, you know, we have multiple constituencies at the Flynn. So we do Broadway, right? We have usually four or five Broadway shows a year. Those sell out. We do world music. Maybe we'll have 400 people at those world music concerts. That's very important to us to do that. We have contemporary dance. Maybe we'll have even less people there. We have ballet. We have more people there. So we have jazz. We have big names in jazz. We have unknown names in jazz. We have the 1,400-seat hall. We have the 200-seat hall. And it's a mixture of, it all drives towards the bottom line. But we're really not a commercial presenter. We do have to have some things that make money. But at the end of the day, it's about what can we bring to Vermont and present the most vibrant artists from around the world. I mean, right now, yesterday I was installing, we have a gallery at the Flynn as well. And Eiko Otake is a Japanese-American choreographer, lives in New York. But she always does kind of site-specific work. And she went back to Fukushima, where those reactors were destroyed in the earthquake and the tsunami. And she went back to where these abandoned spaces are. She was photographed, her body, in the eradicated buildings and the dirt and stuff. And we just hanging these photos, and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, what is this? And then a mom came by, and she knocked on the window, and I waved. And I brought her daughter, and her daughter was about 9 years old. And I had to explain what a tsunami was and what an earthquake was and what a nuclear reactor was. And this little girl was just looking, and it was like, it was one of those moments that the world got bigger. And, you know, I think we try to do that. Yesterday also we had two student matinees. We have 38,000 kids who come in their school buses. And so there were 3,000 kids who were watching actors on stage, sometimes for the first time in their lives.
As you look out there, John, and there are a lot of arts programs that are struggling, I guess is the word. What's the biggest challenge for the arts?
Well, you know, I think we were opened in 1981. It was a very different Burlington then. We were the only thing in town, as it were. And now there's a vibrant community of small, alternative, and mainstream presenters all over Burlington, Chittenden County, and in Vermont, there's a lot. And so I think it's not that we're competing, but we need to partner, and we have to be less centric about our own organization. So we've been doing more and more things with our partners, and we're also doing things off-site. It's important to me that it's not just Flynn-centric, that we ask everybody to come to the Flynn buildings that we have. We've been doing things at the Boys and Girls Club. We do things at Burlington High School. You know, with a lot of the new Americans coming in, it's their parents are struggling. Their first jobs they're getting are dishwashers or, you know, working in hotels. So those parents don't have a lot of free time, and they don't really have a lot of free money. So how do we make sure those kids get an arts experience as well? And they're coming through their schools, but we're also finding we go to the neighborhoods where they are, and it's a much richer exchange.
Let's stay on that subject for a minute. You have a vibrant program for kids. You talked about the kids that have autism and reaching out to those. For why is it important to have that vibrancy in kids, in youth programs, I guess?
Well, in my complete naked self-interest, those are the audiences of tomorrow. So for the Flynn to be vibrant 10, 20 years from now, those kids have to have magical, transformative experiences. So that's on a professional level. On a personal level, I too was a kid. My dad sold cattle at the Chicago Stockyards, right? And I went to the Alvin Ailey Dance Company when I was with my school, and I had never seen any dance before. And I went home that night, and I said, hey, I want to be a modern dancer. And my dad said, what's that? you know. So I see how art changes lives for, you know, everybody. And so I want to make sure the kids in our communities have this rich experience, and then also to make sure it's embedded in them, in their DNA, so that, you know, we also, with the little kids we've been talking about, but we also have relationships with the four colleges that the kids can come for $10, because we want to make sure the college students are also coming to the Flynn, and there's not an access barrier price point at all. So and then we also work with human and social service agencies. There's like 50 of them, and we give them vouchers to have their clients come, because, you know, we're a civic institution and we're publicly funded. Our business model is pretty much a nonprofit one, where 60% comes from earned income, which is our ticket sales and people paying for classes and students coming through their schools. But 40% of our $6.6 million is raised every year through contributed income. And so we are the people's theater. We depend on support of everybody, and I have to earn it every day.
I wanted to pick up on that point, because in Vermont's a small state, so there's a lot of nonprofits out there. They're probably all going to the same people. How do you keep that fundraising effort alive, vibrant? I'm using the word vibrant a lot, but it I think it applies to the arts. How do you keep the fundraising effort new and exciting?
Well, first, there's extraordinary generosity in our corporations that support the Flynn, and our members that support the Flynn, and our donors that support the Flynn. And if you overlay those three groups of people, those are the same people that are probably supporting Shelburne Museum, Burlington City Arts, the Echo Center, but they're also supporting COTS and the Howard Center and Spectrum, because these are people who really want to make sure that the community is vibrant. And to me, rather than seeing it as competition with each other, we're doing more partnerships. And I can't tell you how many people have said that it's so refreshing to kind of be doing things together. And this generosity is pretty fantastic. So they're willing to give us the support. You know, we, like other ones, we do crazy events as well. I mean, you personally jumped off a 9-story building for us over the edge, where we had people rappel down the side of a building, and you had to raise $1,000 for it. And we thought, who's going to do this? This is kind of crazy. But 108 people did it. And I thought at first it was all these people were going to be already supporters of the Flynn. When we looked at actually who did it, many of them were not. They went to the Flynn, of course. They bought tickets, but they were not donors, as we call them. But they were willing to raise $1,000 to do this. So it's a fascinating thing that, you know, like jumping in the lake, you know, for Special Olympics, or the sleepout for COTS. These are really fun things, but they're participatory. And so we thought with the Over the Edge, we would try something, an experiential thing. Because, you know, some of our art is edgy. So we thought, okay, well, sometimes we push our audiences over the edge. Let's see if our community will go over the edge for us. And it worked beautifully.
Is that the trend? I mean, I'm looking, like I said, I want to broaden sort of this discussion out to the arts in general throughout the United States. Is that sort of the trend, that we have to get creative in how we fundraise and what we do? These fun things like the sleep out, like over the edge that you talk about. Is this a trend?
Well, yes, it over the edge is, this is a national thing, and they're having great success all across this country with that. And here's why I think it's important, is that a minute ago we were talking about these donors. Well, a very generous set of people, but many of their businesses have moved out of Vermont, or they've been sold and they no longer hold those businesses. And so the intergenerational transfer of wealth that happened, not necessarily is the interest in the Flynn going to go to the next subsequent generation. So we have to make sure we're always broadening our donor base.
We're speaking with John Kalacki, who's the executive director of the Flynn Center for Performing Arts. If you wish to join our conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. John, I just wanted to ask this question. Where's the arts going, and does technology have any influence on the arts in terms of what's popular and what's not?
Well, I think what we're seeing in this, the production qualities, technology has been profound, because you don't have to be dragging all these sets around. There's been a number of the Broadway shows that are almost completely digital in their sets now. But here's what I think, is that actually people want to have a human experience. They actually want to come together and have a drink and be with their friends and stuff. So, you know, there's a lot of competition out there, but I think if you see something on YouTube or something, you actually want to go and see it live, you know. And if, you know, if you like Bela Fleck and his wife Abigail Washburn, if you got their new album that just won the Grammy, well, of course you want to go see them live. We had a boy band the other night, R5, and you know, the 12 and 14 year old girls were hysterical about this little boy band coming here, and it was so much fun. And they knew, the boy band knew, that afterwards you could get a VIP picture, and you got your picture taken with the boy band, you know, and people were willing to pay more money for that because it's a valuable thing, but it's a human live thing. They loved the boy band from the, you know, listening to them, but they wanted to touch them.
John Noyes would have been there, I think.
he was, actually. We had to escort him out of the theater.
A little too rambunctious.
Last year, there was this effort to eliminate the tax deduction for contributions to nonprofits, not only the Flynn, but other nonprofits as well. It didn't pass. The legislature's back in session now. Are you seeing any effort to resurrect that effort?
Thus far, no. I've heard that there's been no interest in doing that, and it was a kind of move a dollar here, but take it away from somewhere else kind of strategy. What is it? Penny wise, pound foolish. Well, this was beyond foolish, because other states had tried this and they all turned back and saw it was devastating. And, you know, it wasn't just the arts that were impacted. It was all the nonprofits. So, you know, the Health and Human Service agencies were the ones that would be impacted, too. So luckily, we changed some minds there and held that one off.
Before we go to the break, I just wanted to ask this question. The Flynn is thought of as sort of Chittenden County-centric. And you had talked about reaching out. How do you reach out past Chittenden County?
Well, our school programs, we have kids that come from about 90 minutes away. So it's still primarily Chittenden County. But we started doing student matinees up at the Spruce Peak Arts Center in Stowe. And next year, we're talking to the Vermont Stage Company to do one of our student matinees where we live stream it to all schools in Vermont.
And you've had collaboration with the Weston Playhouse as well.
Yes, with the Young Playwrights Festival. So we're trying more and more to do things. The other thing is, before I got here, Flynn had an exclusive agreement that any artist that was performing in Vermont could not perform anywhere else. Well, we dropped that. So we're actually sharing artists, because we're not in competition with the Paramount Theater in Rutland. And we want them to thrive and be successful, too. So sometimes now they'll go from, you know, Rutland to Burlington up to the Northeast Kingdom. And that's as it should be. You know, we should be able to share artists in Vermont.
We're speaking with John Kalacki, who is the executive director of the Flynn Center for Performing Arts. If you wish to join our conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. When we come back, I want to talk to John about a certain presidential candidate that visited the Flynn. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith, along with John Kalacki, who's the executive director of the Flynn Center for Performing Arts. And I love Beardsley's commercial there, where he ties all the presidential candidates and Sarah Palin in there. Interesting commercial, using their own quotes.
And I was headbanging into that intro music, okay? My forehead hurts a little bit here, Mike. Open mic is a dangerous here. I didn't realize that.
Speaking of politics, recently there was some controversy surrounding the visit of a certain presidential candidate, Donald Trump. Why did you make the decision to rent him the facility? What did you learn, and what would you have done differently?
Well, I would say that the Flynn, I think we're a civic institution, and we receive federal dollars from the National Endowment for the Arts. We also receive state dollars from the Vermont Arts Council, as well as a lot of contributions from Vermonters. And I don't know people's party affiliations and are contributors, but I assume it's a very broad spectrum. And we had rented to, in 2004, we had rented to Senator Leahy. He did a fundraiser. We also did a mayoral forum when Moreau was running for mayor the first time. And so we had all three candidates there. And we did something where we had a gov pitch with the then five candidates for governor, the recent happening in September. So we had a precedent that we had politicians speaking, but we're content neutral. We don't endorse any of them. People are there. And so when we got the call, it was like, really? He wants to come to, you know, and it was a week out that they wanted to do this. And but it was, there's no reason we shouldn't do it either. I think it was important that we do remain neutral. And, you know, it's, we weren't endorsing a candidate, but we were endorsing the right for someone to speak. Now, it was absolutely interesting the kind of disruption it caused, because, you know, he has inflammatory rhetoric. People couldn't believe that somehow I had...
and he has small hands.
Yeah, oh my gosh. That has come to that. Then last night he's defending. It's like, oh, please, boys.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Boys. I couldn't help it.
You know, but here's what was interesting about it for me. It was very disruptive. It was the day before New Year's Eve that we got contacted. It was July 7th that it happened. Over the weekend, the man that we were dealing with out of the New Hampshire office of the campaign was fired. So on Sunday, a new guy came in, and there we were with the Secret Service, the mayor, the police, and the Flynn staff talking to the new campaign person for some on Sunday for something that was happening on, you know, 2 days later. And so there was a lot of chaos around it. There was, as political campaigns do, when it's a free event, they oversubscribe it to make sure it's full. So they had, sent out, and they kept opening up the registration. When they sent out a confirmation thing, there were about 6,500 valid emails that they had. So, the police department decided it was not a public safety risk. And I thought Burlington had a great time with it. Ultimately, there were people outside for and against. There were people inside for and against. And it was very disruptive, which was, I think, great in this process. I mean, I just heard you talk, you know, at 9 o'clock, you were talking about the disruption that happens. Change happens from the fringes. So Mr. Trump and Sanders are from the fringe in their parties, and they are forcing change. Just as the Tea Party forced change, I'm saying Trump is forcing change. Now, it's interesting what will happen with all this. What I saw that night was that he was a viable candidate, that people there were supportive of him. The news media, I felt, was fascinating, and that I felt they were complicit, and that they were only talking about the disruption and not really about what he was saying. Like, what is this man's platform? There was no analysis done. When CNN interviewed me out in front of the Flynn, when we finished, I said, so why are you here? Burlington's a small market. And the CNN guy said, oh, God, I got to follow him everywhere. I said, but you're not talking about what he's saying inside. You're out in front about the protest, which is fine. I'm glad you're here. All the press was like that. Everyone wanted to talk about, you know, what the controversy was. But it's like, well, let's talk about the candidate.
Let's get off politics for back to arts, but not back to arts. I want to talk horses for a minute. You are
well. Here's the thing. Can I go? Let me say this, Mike. I think that art and politics are very similar. If someone comes to a show and they have an expectation and they don't like it, they tell me about it. I don't like it. It's like, well, when is like a criteria? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I say to my staff and to the board, which you are part of the board of the Flynn, if you like everything that we do, I've done something wrong. You know, if we're going to have a vibrant array of stuff, there has to be something you don't like. And the same thing is, I think that the Trump visit made us in Vermont have conversations that are uncomfortable and that we have differences. And, you know, it wasn't just outsiders coming in. It was Vermonters there who had very polarized viewpoints. And it's a healthy democracy. The First Amendment is messy, But it's really, it's a good thing we have it.
I neglected to say at the top of the hour, at the top of the interview here, that I am a board member of the Flynn. I want to make that disclosure to our audience. What? Let's switch to ponies, because how did you get involved in ponies? And you're very involved in ponies.
I was there this morning.
These aren't the racing ponies.
No. I have a little fat little Shetland pony that pulls me around in a cart. And as a kid, I loved Shetland ponies. And my midlife crisis, you know, instead of getting a fancy car, I bought a $400 pony and spent way too much money boarding her at a stable. But here's what it is. I hook her up on the cart. We have a good time together. It's everything, no stress. She's always happy to see me. You know, I'm doing something where I'm a beginner. I'm learning. The teenage girls know more than I do. I often turn to people for advice. And at the barn, one's day job doesn't exist. You know, the pony's name is Raindrop, and I'm just Raindrop's dad there. And so, you know, and I turn to somebody's horse and, you know, talk to them about their horse. It's great to have this completely other world where there's no stress for me.
Let's turn to the broader subject, back to the arts. Why is it important to support the arts?
I think the arts give us a real beautiful, visceral sense of the other, of difference. And it gives us enjoyment. Joy is a very important thing. You know, even sometimes anger, if you're really angry about something. I think art has all these kinds of things. It takes us outside of ourselves, and I think makes us more fully human. That it gives us empathy. It allows us to sympathize sometimes in a way. But I think celebration, coming together and celebrate. And gosh, you know, joy is important in our lives every day. And I work every day at the Flynn trying to bring joy into people's lives.
If people wanted to find out more information about the Flynn, where would they go?
Well, flynncenter.org is our Flynn site, of course, our website there. Or if you want to just call for Flynn Ticks, it's 86 Flynn, 86 FLYNN. You can call and get those tickets for Bella Fleck and Abigail Washburn tonight at the Flynn.
John, as always, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. And Mike, thank you for being on the air. You're an important voice here in Vermont.
Well, thank you very much for that. Coming up, we'll have a check-in with our friends at Talk Media News, and then more phone calls. And Ken Squire, I don't know what he is going to say, but he wants to weigh in on presidential politics. You never know what Ken is going to say. And then this name is trips me up every time. Catriona McHardy. Can you? That's
Catriona McHardy.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Judge. She will be coming up, and she will be talking about. She's being inducted to the Vermont State College Hall of Fame, and we'll talk to her about that because she's got a fascinating background here. What I want to make you aware of is that you can always listen to this program by going on to the WDEVradio.com website, clicking on the Open Mic podcast, and picking any show you wish to hear. Sometimes you have to go outside. You have to do something for business, and you can hear this broadcast anytime, anywhere, actually. This is Open Mic on WDEV Radio News, AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And as I said, we're always streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I know some people in Portugal who are listening at the moment. This is Open Mic. We're going to be turning to our friends at Talk Media News in just a moment. And who's on the line, Tom? It is Victoria Jones. Victoria, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. What's your take on the debate?
Well, I'm not sure it was a debate, really, was it? It was more of a brawl. I mean, when you've got everybody talking at the same time and you can't hear what they say, and anyway, they're not talking about anything of substance.
Well, it's interesting. It seems like everything is being Twittered today or talked about today about hands, not about policy issue.
What was it, hands? I'm not sure that was hands they were talking about.
No, it started out with hands, Victoria, didn't it?
Well, it's, let's say, put it this way, it started out with hands and then it went down from there.
Sort of speak. Hey, what happens now? We've got some, what do you think the American people are thinking? The Republican establishment is trying to stop Donald Trump. I don't know if Mitt Romney was the right person to trot out for that, but nonetheless, there are people that are trying, within the Republican Party, trying to stop Trump. Where does this go? What happens from here?
Well, at the moment, it looks like he's on his way to the nomination, because it doesn't look as though the two contenders, because Kasich really is not strong enough unless he wins Ohio by which he might, but even then he doesn't seem to have another path to the nomination. The two contenders, Rubio and Cruz, don't look like they're going to unite. And that being said, it looks as though he's on his way to the nomination. And the only thing that could stop him is the Associated Press is reporting that he, at the moment, is getting about 48% of the delegates, and he needs to get 52% of the delegates to have enough delegates to clinch it at this point. So he does need to up his game slightly, but there's nothing to suggest that he won't do that.
You know what's interesting today? The Washington Post and The Hill had stories about where is Trump money for veterans. Can you just explain what's going on there?
Yeah, this is very interesting. This rumor and story has been floating around on the internet for a few weeks now. You may remember that Trump boycotted a debate at the end of January in a feud with Fox News, who was the host. And instead, that night, he conducted a fundraiser, vowing that the proceeds would benefit groups that aid military veterans. A lot of people were skeptical about this, by the way, considering that he's only given $57,000 to veterans out of the many millions of dollars that he's allegedly given to charity. So he claimed that night that he'd raised $6 million for military veterans. So the Washington Post started to dig into this. Well, about $3 million has made its way to 24 charities that he picked as beneficiaries. And bear in mind that of that $3 million, $1.5 million was given by billionaires themselves, and only about $1.5 million originated from small donors. So where's the rest of the money?
Hmm.
Nobody knows.
And I suspect that's going to become a campaign issue very, very shortly here.
Yes, I would think so, very much so. And, of course, like his taxes, he may or may not answer it.
We have a Supreme Court vacancy. What's the latest on the Supreme Court?
Well, the latest on the Supreme Court is that there is still no nominee, but President Obama is said to be going through books and pages of potentials, and is also said not to have closed the book on adding names, but he is said to be reviewing nominees who not only have received past Republican support, but also have ties with top Republican lawmakers.
And who would that be?
Well, there's a couple that are mentioned today in the Wall Street Journal. One of them was mentioned yesterday in the New York Times, too, and that is U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Jane Kelly out of Iowa, who would be well known to Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Chuck Grassley, a Republican, also from Iowa. She was confirmed unanimously in 2013, and she was praised effusively by Chuck Grassley at that time. Also, U.S. District Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, who was also confirmed unanimously, and she is a relative of Speaker Paul Ryan.
So is that the way you get nominated, to be a relative of a major political person?
Well, it's the way you get mentioned in a news story, certainly.
We talked about the Republicans and the Republican debate last night. What about the Democrats? Bernie Sanders held a his strategist and campaign manager held a press conference here in Vermont and said that they have a path to victory. What's your take on this?
Well, they definitely say they have a path to victory, and if nothing else, they're going all the way to the convention, so they're not going to stop, and they've got the money. I mean, they've raised about $40 million. They've had some extremely good days in particular for raising enormous amounts of money. So there's no onus on Bernie Sanders to quit for financial reasons, and there's every reason for him to continue. He also believes that the primary calendar on Super Tuesday was very much against him because of so many states in the South, and that the calendar starts to look much better for him going forward, and that there are a number of very good states coming up. So that he thinks that if he hangs on and keeps campaigning the way he's been campaigning, that things will turn around.
I found curious over the weekend, there was at the Democratic National Committee, there was sort of a defection with the number two person that resigned and endorsed Bernie Sanders. Why do you think she did it, and why now?
It's hard to tell why now, really. I think she did it out of conviction. It certainly didn't do her any good within Democratic Party circles.
And what one of the things I've been curious about, and I took a little bit of heat on this yesterday when I was mentioning it, I compared Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. And before you jump out of your skin, let me explain what I'm talking about. I'm not talking policy stuff. I'm not talking, you know, positions on how they would solve various things. They're diametrically opposed. I get that. But what they have seemed to have done is touched a nerve with voters that, in my mind, is certainly resonating. That is that the political system is controlled by elites. And you hear even Donald Trump saying this. Of course, it's Washington Insiders, as he says that. And they have voters who are angry out there, really believing that these elites, their sole purpose is to perpetuate their own power over politics and the economy. And both of those candidates recognized early on the voter anger, and it's profound, the voter anger out there. Am I being just completely off base here, Victoria?
No, I think they both tapped into something very, very real. And I think that's why there is such enthusiasm for those two candidates in a way that you probably have not seen for the more establishment candidates.
Hey, Victoria, as always, it's been great talking to you and getting your perspective. I really appreciate your time, and have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
That's Victoria Jones from Talk Media News. Up next, our own Ken Squires, and I have no idea what he's going to be talking about, but he wants to talk presidential politics. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In a little while, we'll speak with Ken Squires about presidential politics and get his take on it. I have no idea what he's going to say. But we started out today with talking about presidential politics and how Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are similar in their message in terms of what they are saying, how they have connected. They've touched a nerve with voters that is certainly resonating. That the political system is all rigged. It's rigged and controlled by elites whose sole interest is perpetuating their own power over politics and our economy. And I didn't, you know, yesterday we brought this same subject up and I got a lot of response off air on this thing. And we're not talking about the voter anger. Where they differ is how they would address the voter anger. And it is in this area that they are diametrically opposed. Policy issues and solutions aside, and they are profound between the two people, Trump and Sanders. They have found success in Vermont and elsewhere in this country by establishing a connection with a growing number of voters out there that feel disenfranchised in the political process and telling them that they finally have a voice with either Trump or Sanders. And that is something that is that has been interesting, to say the least. I have Ken Squires coming into my booth. And Ken, I'm going to give you the floor because I think you told me you have some things to say about politics here in Vermont and across the country.
I'm sick of it. I'm sick, sick, sick.
Are you sick of the results or are you sick of...
I'm sick of the whole shooting match.
So what would you do?
In every... what's it say, Artie, in Ecclesiastics? In every time there is
to
a
everything
season,
there is
a season.
Season. Yes.
Turn. You realize...
Three-part harmony.
Yeah, right, I didn't realize we were going into the birds.
But there is a season. Well, this one's running through four seasons and then going four more. There's not another form of democracy that takes this long to get to the revelation, to revealing who their leaders are going to be. And I think all of us are sick and tired and worn out with all the horsepucky that we've been listening to. And we have several months more of this same thing. And now they're parsing words and they're pointing fingers, none of which will be remembered. And I don't know where we're going. My only conclusion is that we're so darn smart in Vermont because we know what the deal is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Secession. We have to secede. We've got to start our own thing and get out of this
mess. I didn't see that coming.
Well, let me tell you. I mean, here we are. Our neighbors, our friends to the north, they do it in, what, 60 days?
They do it really quick.
45 days or something in England. And let's see, what's the other one? Australia. They do it in about a month and a half, 2 months. And they get this all done. And these people are beating us over the head, bloodied, with all of this language and hypocritical stuff. It's just wrong because that we're taking our eye off what the rest of the world is doing and what we need to be doing in the rest of the world as we continue these little debate sessions and all television can talk about for the 2 or 3 days or the number of days before the next one is what they said the last time and compare it to the previous 4 or 5 or 8. And this just keeps going on, and we have our eye off the ball. And I am sure that in the rest of the world, they see this as hee-haw, that they are just having a wonderful time at our expense watching this continuation of foolishness. Tell us what you mean and what you want to do, and go along and do it.
You don't think hand size is important?
No, I don't think any of that. That's a good point, but it's not a good point. It's the points that they keep making, and the former candidate, Republican candidate,
Mitt Romney,
and now he looks just as sleazy as the rest. He could have said that 4 years ago and probably been president, but dealing with just be as forthright. And that's the one thing that people like about Trump. Right, wrong, indifferent, a bit of a salesman, that's for darn sure.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't do that. They mince words. 4 years ago, Romney was saying, what a wonderful experience to be on the... And as I understand, didn't like the guy then, Trump. But he wouldn't say it because he was getting millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
At just like Hillary, $225,000 or $265,000 times three.
So what I'm hearing you say, either change the system or get the heck out.
Yeah. No, you can't get the heck out because democracy's too good a thing. But these guys have got it wound up, fudged up to the point now where there's... where people are just going to get sick and tired of all of them. And that's what started this one all off. We were sick and tired of a Congress that couldn't seem to get their left foot in front of their right or their right foot in front of their left and get anything done. And we wanted people in there. So a guy came stomping and screaming, you know, on out of the sidelines, and not a politician, got them all wound up, and the fever is still on. And we've got Hillary running, and she's taken, $3 or $4 million from the folks that we really have to be bothered and worried about. What are all those names of those companies that...
The Wall Street companies?
Yeah, Wall Street.
Yeah, the Goldman Sachs.
The Goldman Sachs.
Yep.
So here's the deal. If you or I were to call, huh? If Mike Smith were to call, say he wanted to talk to the president about anything that he thought was of consequence and importance, do you think he'd get even past the first lady on the telephone system up the line? Not a chance. But if someone from Goldman Sachs, who had provided somewhat $6-7 million, was on the phone, well, by damn, there's where the problem is. I mean, we don't, everything that we thought we were kind of aiming to straighten out is just as muddled as it was before because of all the money and so forth that gets tossed into the ring. To make these be, and imagine the hundreds of millions of dollars that are being spent, and at a point, one politician turns around, looks at the situation, and says, "Okay, I'm out." For what? We've had all these grandiose speeches. Sick of it. Sick of it. Sick of it.
You know what I would like is $250,000 for speaking to Goldman Sachs. That seems to be a good day's work.
Well, yes, but she did it with four or five of those groups.
Yeah.
So I would think those are people she has to know pretty well. There had to be a luncheon, and then there had to be a dinner after, and a chance to really get acquainted. And that's what it is. And she may be as honest as the world is dishonest.
Are you going to stick around, or are you going to leave me with all these phone calls?
No, I'm going to leave now.
Thank you so much.
But I'm so bloody irritated with this. It's a sadness that we trap ourselves, and television does it. Presumably radio does it as well. But the television, with all these continuing discussions about this, there's some other things going on in the world. There's some other things going on in the United States of America. There are a lot of tough things that are coming along for the Green Mountain state of Vermont, certainly not the richest. And to have all of this under the umbrella that these loons have put up doesn't make any sense.
Thank you very much. Let me try to clear the phone lines here because Ken Squire has really lit them up. Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Rama, you're on open mic, and I think it's my job to sort of... Listen.
Well, if it's Rama, I don't want to talk.
No. Well, actually, you know, I just heard Mike ask for a huge pay raise, and Ken endorsed Bernie Sanders. That's pretty incredible. So while
can you
we're
see
on
what happened, Mike?
For...
Can you see what happens here?
Yeah,
now
well,
there's where it starts.
So I'm asking.
That's
for
his
a
interpretation.
Job again, Ken.
This is his interpretation, and now he wants it. Now he's sitting here because he's got on the radio, and he wants a job too.
Yeah. Well.
Oh my heart.
Okay, but assuming that the last of those three isn't going to happen, Mike's probably not going to get the pay raise, and we'll wait and see on the Bernie part. I just want to point, you know, Mike, I made mention quickly yesterday, you were talking about the Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, and I made the mention that I, you know, Donald Trump, and I don't think Bernie Sanders either, but Donald Trump specifically at this point, he's not out of the mainstream Republican Party. He is where the Republican Party has been headed for the last 20, 30, maybe 40 years. Don't forget, this is the crew that brought us Sarah Palin as a vice presidential candidate. Donald Trump is just a natural extension of everything that has been going on at the national level of the Republican Party for decades now. And make no mistake, the only reason that he's getting the votes and not somebody like Rubio and Cruz, Donald Trump is saying what they want to say, only he's saying it in a more blunt and crass language. That's it, period.
Thanks, Rama. Let's go to Rick.
I like Rama so much. really good. He's a hot shot.
Let's go to Rob in North Carolina. Rob, you're on open mic.
Hey, good morning, guys. To Rama's point, and Bernie Sanders is reflecting what the Democrat Party in their direction in the last 20, 30, 40 years, socialism. So, you know, it's both extremes. They're both sides are upset on both ends. Hey, Mike, did you get a chance to see what Jim Webb said this morning on Morning Joe about Hillary Clinton?
I didn't, but Ken, you're a regular watcher of that show.
No, I'm a Jim Webb enthusiast.
Yeah, Jim Webb, I think, Mike, maybe Ken, that's a candidate I could easily pull the lever for president of the United States. I've liked this guy all along. I know he's a Democrat, but, you know, I was mightily disappointed when he got out of the debate. I couldn't understand it, but I think he made it clear. This party is not what it used to be, in Jim's opinion. And I think Jim represents the best in America. And this morning, in Morning Joe, he said emphatically, I will not vote for Hillary Clinton. I was watching this, and I said, what?
Well, that's...
And then he talked about Donald Trump and began to give Donald Trump some advice that he needs to get out there with a policy statement, much like Barack Obama did when the media started to come down on him a bit about Jeremiah Wright and his association with that particular brand of preaching. So, you know, and Joe asked him, well, would you support Donald Trump? Said, well, I'm going to have to think about it some more. So I think what Jim is saying is he sees strength in Trump and he sees sleaze in Clinton. And he said, if you elect Clinton, you're not going to clean out the stables. So I thought that was pretty amazing, guys.
Thanks, Rob.
That's what I have to talk this morning. Take care.
Thank you. Let's go to Dick in St. Albans. Dick.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Ken.
Morning.
Are you confused?
No, not particularly.
Yeah, well, I'm not confused either. And you let these clowns keep doing what they're doing, and what they basically are, the agenda here is to basically take down this country. And what they've done in the Middle East, creating civil wars by taking down sovereign governments over there, they're also planning on doing it inside this country, too. So all you need is one big event here, watching this circus going on here, and that's when the herd bolts, and they all head to the bank to pull out their money, or they head and sell all their stocks, and you end up going down the tubes financially here. So this is no fun and games what we're watching here. It's serious business.
Well, you're always so dark. And
no, I'm not dark. I'm reality here.
Well, you think you're reality, but I question some of it. And I really have a problem. Yes, I think the rest of the world is looking at us through those kind of glasses. And we will somehow succeed because we are the United States. But to have to put up with this in this manner and not deal with anything of serious consequence except the egos of these people running for office, it's nuts.
Do you think this may be the beginning of the end for the two-party system?
Yes.
Yeah.
I sent the fellow that runs that Bloomberg group is sitting there, and we certainly heard Romney sound like it. And the gentleman that called, the guy that I would have voted for in a heartbeat, he didn't last through one of those things. What was his name?
Jim Webb.
Jim Webb, United States Navy, Secretary of the Navy.
Yeah, I think it was a Marine, but Secretary of the Navy.
Well, no, Secretary of the Navy, and then in the Navy, and you may be right that he ended up in the Marines.
Yeah, but the Marines are part of the Navy. Now, every Marine out there, don't call me. No, it is a fact, but... Yeah.
But the point is that guy, he didn't just talk. He was over there, and he got shot at. And he was down there in the trenches, seriously. I think he was wounded once, twice, and he's got a son over there now. So he really understands what these other people say they understand, and what they're doing is reading off policy papers. And at the same time, he's an incredible humanitarian. His memoir book about the time he finally quit, you know, he's a congressman from Virginia, he's us. He's the real us. He is the real Donald Trump because he knows and has the fear in him of what happens if we don't get this straightened around. Yeah.
Well, Artie, I'm going to try to clear these.
Glad to help out.
Thank you so much. I'm going to try to clear these phone lines because I've got to get on to the next guest. But Fred from Newberry. Fred, can you make it real quick?
Yeah, okay. I'll try. The Trump Infrastructure Restoration Act is going to make a big difference. You'll get thousands of votes. You'll say it's going to cost a lot of money, but the multiplier effect of all this money will put money in lots of pockets. And then the other one on Webb. Webb is left-handed. Four consecutive left-handed presidents. The chances of that ever happening are one in a billion.
Thanks, Fred.
That's good. Thank you.
Ken, as always, thank you very much for lighting up my phone bank here.
That's what I do, light my fire.
That's Ken Squire. We'll be up next, and we'll talk about the Vermont State College Hall of Fame induction.
Great idea.
This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. It's Crazy Friday here on Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We just had we're all over the place today in terms of what we're doing with topics. We've gone from politics to arts, and now we're going to something that I think is very important out there. It's the Hall of Fame. It's the first annual Vermont State College Hall of Fame. And in front of me in our WDEV studios is an inductee who will be celebrating her induction on March 9th. It's Katarina McCarty. Did I get that right?
Almost. Okay. Almost right, Mike. It's Katrina McCarty.
Katrina.
Right. Like the hurricane.
Yeah, and
just
I...
Just remember that.
And I... And I've been mispronouncing it all day long because I look at the spelling of it, mm-hmm. and it's totally different.
Yes. In fact, until I was 22, I hated the name because my teachers always did the same thing. So don't worry about it. It's Katrina.
And just for those who want to believe that I'm a dope out there, I mean, it is spelled C-A-T-R-I-O-N-A.
It's Gaelic.
It's Gaelic.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
When we talk about Gaelic, just out of curiosity, I mean, I visited Cape Breton and big Gaelic community in Cape Breton.
Yeah.
Where is this name from?
It's from, well, I'm Scottish. I was born in Glasgow. I was actually named after my mother's best friend. And then my best friend named her daughter after me. And now we're waiting to see if there's going to be a girl, a best friend that gives her a girl, and see what happens. But it is originally, there's a book, follow-up to Kidnap by Robert Louis Stevenson, and it's called Katrina.
Okay. Now, I tried to make you into a figure skater by calling you Katarina, and I've tried to, but it's Katrina, and it's Katrina McCarty. And one of the things I wanted to talk about is, can you sort of tell us a little bit about your background? Because as I was looking at you, you've been 32 years at Planned Parenthood of England.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you get there?
Well, actually, I started working in Planned Parenthood in 1979, and I applied for a job in Brattleboro, Vermont. It was one of the sites that Planned Parenthood had. I applied for a job as a healthcare assistant. I got in. I got the job, and I just sort of worked my way up. And I was sometimes at the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And other times I kind of bullied my way, but I got there.
And your current position is the VP of Education and Training. What do you do?
Well, let me correct that a little bit. I retired in 2011.
Ah, okay.
From Planned Parenthood.
You look too young to be retired.
Yeah, thank you. At the end of 2011. So I've been retired from Planned Parenthood for about, 5 years. And at that time, I started also teaching at CCV. And that's what I do now, very part-time. But, mm-hmm. yeah.
What do you teach?
I teach, there's five different courses that I teach, not every semester, but I teach human sexuality, which is really my background, And I also teach three communication courses, intercultural, interpersonal, and effective workplace communication. And I teach race and ethnicity, class and gender.
One of the things that I was really fascinated about your background is when you were at Planned Parenthood, mm-hmm. what sort of things, it was about women's health. That
absolutely.
And what sort of, what are some of the, I guess, the bigger issues dealing with women's health that you dealt with?
Well, I wasn't in the medical. There were several parts to Planned Parenthood. I was in the education department most of my tenure at Planned Parenthood. But the main mission of Planned Parenthood is to provide reproductive and sexual health, and make it accessible and affordable for all women.
Well, let
and that doesn't mean we don't serve men as well, we do. So I'm still in the present with Planned Parenthood somehow, but yes, Planned Parenthood serves men as well as women, but it is more focused on female reproductive health.
Staying 32 years in one place, that's quite an accomplishment. Right. What motivated you to just stay where you are?
I love the mission. I love the organization. And what I learned from going to CCV was that, I could do a lot more than I ever thought I could. So that's what CCV gave me. It gave me a pathway to think about how I could do the best that I could do. And so when I went and started working at Planned Parenthood, I took that with me. And every time there was an opportunity that I thought I'd be interested in, I took it.
Now, I find your background fascinating, so please forgive me. Sure. I'm going back to the Glasgow days. How'd you get from Glasgow to here?
Oh, my gosh. Well, now we're not talking about CCV or Planned
Parenthood.
I'm going
to come back to it, okay. Please.
Yeah. My mom and dad were very adventurous people. And in a time when I don't know that there was that much adventure for people like them, they were young and they were poor and there wasn't a lot of choices in Glasgow or in Scotland. They decided that they, together, my dad signed a contract. They went out on a Saturday night. They went to a meeting. It was advertised in the local Glasgow paper and came back and to my grandmother's house where I was and said, we're moving to South Africa. And he signed a 5-year contract to work in the diamond mines in Johannesburg. So we went there for 5 years and then we came back and to Glasgow and then we stayed about a year and then we emigrated to Montreal.
And your education was mostly in Montreal?
All in Montreal, yes.
Montreal.
Yeah.
And then how'd you get to Vermont?
I married an American in 1966 and I moved to New York and we lived there for 5 years and then I moved to Vermont.
And that's where you were introduced into Planned Parenthood.
Right. CCV first and then Planned Parenthood.
Let me ask you this. What does it mean to be selected for the Vermont State College Hall of Fame?
Well, first of all, I'm so proud of it. And second of all, I'm just deeply touched that I was chosen because I know there's a lot of alum out there and a lot of very incredible people that went through CCV. I thank them from my heart for that. I'm very proud of it because I absolutely love the mission of CCV. It's sort of similar to Planned Parenthood in a way. You know, it's about accessibility, it's about affordability, and it's about giving people chances and giving them quality education at CCV.
What I find fascinating is, I just find your career fascinating. So looking at your career, what experiences at CCV, at Planned Parenthood, and now, do you think sort of molded you?
What a great question. When I walked in the door at CCV to take my first course, which was called, and I chose it, and I don't know why, but I chose it. It was called Midwives, Mill Girls, Militants, Midwives, and Mill Girls, A Look at Vermont History, Women's History. And I took the course, and it just opened up a whole new world for me. It just piqued my curiosity. I wanted to know more about women in the world. I wanted to understand history. And so that was my start. And I think I took that curiosity and that, you know, that desire to learn more and more through my career at Planned Parenthood. So when an opportunity came up at Planned Parenthood, like, for instance, to go out of the health center and go into the high schools and talk to teenagers, I jumped at it. Off I went.
You seem to have this mission of community service. Was that instilled by your parents? Was it something that you learned at CCV? Where did that come from? I'm always curious where people get that drive for community service.
Yeah, that's interesting, Mike, because I am very community-oriented. I'm very people-oriented, so of course I'm community-oriented, but I never thought about it that way. I think that, you know, when I became a young woman, it was at the time when the women's movement was just starting. So I remember 1969. I remember what
we were
supposed to
do. So do I, by the way.
And, you know, I read my first Ms. magazine, and I became, you know, I was political. And the political part of me comes from my mother and my father, particularly my dad. But I just had political, you know, genes in my body since I was young. And I also, my mom and dad also taught me about equality. So I was always pushing those two things. So CCV gave me the confidence and the support, and then I went out and did the work at Planned Parenthood.
Have you ever thought about getting into politics yourself?
People have asked me that before, and I think it's a really hard job. And I'm glad I'm not in it this year, yeah, in particular. But I have friends that are in the Vermont legislation, and, you know, I like politics.
We're speaking to Katrina McCartney, who is going to be inducted into the Vermont State College Hall of Fame. We'll continue our discussion in a moment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Katrina McCarty, and I'm sorry, Katrina. I've been mispronouncing your name all day long.
And I know. For a minute, I thought I was the cousin of Paul McCartney.
Yeah, I know.
That was good. I wish.
Hey, let's go back and talk about CCV, for example.
Yes. It
has a niche that's important in Vermont. And can you sort of, as being a teacher at CCV, why is CCV important?
I think CCV is vital to the state of Vermont. I mean, it was certainly vital to me, and I can still see it. And when I walk into a classroom and meet a new group of students, I can see myself in almost all of them. And I think it gives young people an opportunity who have never been to college before. So there's a lot of first-generation students still attending CCV as they were when I was there. So about 50% of the students at CCV are first-generation. And I can break it down a little bit, and I can tell you that 61% of them are first-generation in Newport, and 53% of them are first generation in St. Albans. And then the lower center is Winooski, although it's the largest center. 37% of them are first generation students. So it sort of evens out to about 50%. And I think that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And magnificent. And I think it's It's something that Vermont should be proud of, and I think CCV does a great job with first-generation students.
We're speaking with Katrina McHardy, who is going to be an inductee into the inaugural Hall of Fame at the Vermont State College System, and that's going to be happening March 9th. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. What advice do you give to students?
Well, I know that sometimes, you know, when you are, you're working hard, you might have a job, it might be full-time, might be part-time, but you might have a family, you might be a single mom, you might be a single dad. I've had single dads in my class too, and they're pretty magnificent. They're all magnificent. And I just tell them not to let go, not to give up, to keep going and to, look for things that really interest them and inspire them, or ways that they want to, when they find something and get curious about it, go for it. You know, dig deeper, see what you want to do. And of course, most of them are thinking about, yeah, well, that's great, but I have to get a job. Getting an associate's degree from CCV is the first step to, like, changing your life. And I tell them that all the time.
I'm just curious, what kind of teenager were you? Were you rambunctious? Were you... I'm curious, because you have that fire in your eye.
I wasn't a good girl, Mike. I was not a good girl. I was a little bit of a rebel. I had a great adolescence. I did a lot of things, and I got caught a lot of times.
Well, that's interesting. I have a similar background, actually.
Yes.
Why? I want to get back to the award, because there are some fairly big names that are being inducted into this Hall of Fame, and a lot of people that made enormous contributions, including yourself, in the lives of many Vermonters. To you personally, what does this mean?
Being the chosen alum for CCV is, I've received awards before, and national awards and others, and this one sort of tops it, because it's where I started. Oh, I'm going to get a little teary. It's where I started. It's what boosted me. It's what it was CCV that told me that I could do it. So I'm proud, really proud.
You should be. What, one of the things that I was thinking about is, as I was sort of going over your background, is there one moment that sticks out that you say, the 32 years you were at Planned Parenthood, is there one moment that sticks out where you said, I did this right?
I think there were many moments where I realized it, and there were lots of moments where I forgot it, because it was hard work as well. I think as often as I can think of times where that happened at Planned Parenthood, I think it happens also at CCV. And so there's
I was going to ask you the same question,
yeah,
CCV.
It's so similar. Working with young people, because I was that rebel, because I can remember it quite well, even though it was a long time ago. And because I'm a people person, I love working, and I love communicating with people. And so I try to help them see who they are and push forward. And so every time I walk into a classroom at CCV, I have that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. At CCV, when you walk into a classroom, is there one, what motivates you when you walk into that classroom and you look in the eyes of those students? What motivates you?
I want to know who they are. I want to know what their life is like, and I want them to have opportunity. And so I go in thinking those three things, and I'm curious about them. I hope they're curious about what they're learning, and I'm curious about them.
What do you do when you're not at CCVD.
Well,
what's your hobby?
I have several hobbies. People mostly. I love my friends. I love to walk. I love music. We go out and listen to live music a lot still. I love to dance. And I love my family. I've got two daughters. One's in Portland, Oregon, and one's in Massachusetts. And I have one granddaughter.
Do you love fiddling?
I don't fiddle. My dad fiddled, or he played the violin, but I don't.
Because if you ever go to Cape Breton, as you perhaps have done.
I have, yeah.
I mean, that is the national sport, is the fiddling and dancing.
Yes. And I used to go to the violin or the fiddle contests up in Craftsbury in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great time.
Let's get back to the award. And one of the things, and we're talking about the Vermont State College Hall of Fame Award that Katrina McCarty is going to get on March 9th. And it's you look at the inductees, and it's the inaugural inductee, and it's certainly worthy of a Hall of Fame, including yourself, Katrina. The one thing that I really wanted to know is, what does your family think about this?
I think my family is pretty excited about it. My mom and dad are both dead. But my family and my partner and my friends are very excited about it. Of course, they all wanted to be there, and that can't happen, but that's okay. There's going to be a great representation of them there. And I think they're proud of me.
What are you going to say?
Because
I suspect they're going to ask you to say something.
Yes, I have 3 minutes. Do you believe that?
Give us one.
Give you one. I'm going to say that it was the walking in the front door of CCV in 1976 was probably the best thing I ever did in my life.
Thank you so much for joining us here.
You're welcome.
And
it was a pleasure.
And I apologize for looking at the spelling and getting this name wrong.
Please don't worry about it.
That's Katrina McCarty.
That's right.
And she is going to be getting the inaugural award. She's going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame at the Vermont State College, along with many other notable names. I want to thank her today, as well as John Kalacki, our executive director from the Flynn Center for Performing Arts. I want to thank Ken Squire for lighting up all my phone lines and on his take on politics. And what we're going to do next week is another jam-packed week, with starting on Tuesday when we speak with departing executive director of the ACLU, Alan Gilbert, and he will be joining us the next week. This is Open Mic on WDEV Radio News AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk again on Tuesday.